Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week, we kicked off our How to Be Smarter series, and we all got a little smarter about things like Jay-Z, the Riot Girl movement, and Van Morrison's album Astral Weeks. But of all the things we did, the one that touched a nerve was our segment, How to Be Smarter About Speakers. We got calls from listeners telling us about their crazy wiring solutions for their home sound system. One listener asked us how those $3,000 disc speakers sound. Like I'd know how a $3,000 speaker sounds. And we got an earful from Aaron in New York.
This is such a disservice to your listeners. This is serious, you know? I mean, you're into music. It's like, you know, someone's dying of thirst in the desert and you give them water out of a puddle. Oh, it's great, yeah.
Ouch. Fortunately, we got another call from Aaron in New York.
Mr. Schaefer, I calmed down. I'm sorry. You wanted to learn more about speakers. The only real change is technologically, I mean, there's small refinements, but just learning it psychoacoustically, you can get by with one subwoofer. It's still going to have to be big if you want deep bass. There's just trade-offs between efficiency, the depth of bass, and the size.
So Aaron actually answered our question about speakers. Does size matter? With subwoofers, at least, the answer seems to be yes. So thanks, Aaron. Today, we'll make you a little smarter about Gem Club, a band who play beautiful chamber pop songs and will play for us in just a bit. And we'll revisit one of the most famous soundtracks of the last 10 years, from the film Garden State. But first, here's how important music is on TV. Let me play you this. You hear that and you know we're talking about the HBO drama The Sopranos. What about this? Well, now we're back in the booze-soaked 1960s with the AMC series Mad Men. The common thread between those two shows is Matthew Weiner. He created Mad Men after working as a writer and producer on The Sopranos. Now he's directed a new movie called Are You Here?, starring Owen Wilson, Zach Galifianakis, and Amy Poehler. And Matthew Weiner is here to share a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck today. Hi, Matthew.
It's great to be here, John.
So you are known to the cognoscenti as someone with a keen ear for music.
It's very important to me. I listen to it when I write, and had a big record collection, had a cassette tape collection.
Dating yourself, but okay.
any form, mobile mm-hmm. form, putting it in the car was amazing. That was a big step.
Right. This is your directorial debut in film.
Yes.
Is it different working with music in the two media, TV and film?
You can have more than one song in a movie. You know, usually we have financial concerns on the show, and we can never really have more than one, cue that's not a composer or what we call a library cue.
Right.
But I had some of these songs that are in the movie in the script.
So from very early on in the conception of the story, you already have soundtrack decisions.
Absolutely.
Going. Well, now there's a moment in the film Are You Here? Where the music goes very much from being in the background to momentarily almost being like a commentary on the relationship potentially between two of the characters. This is Owen Wilson and Laura Ramsey. Owen's character has been out with Zach's character, in the bars, and he's come back to this rural place where Laura's character comes out. Well, let me play this.
Okay,
this is from Matthew Weiner's forthcoming film called Are You Here?
Done celebrating?
You gotta come out here. You gotta see this.
Where's Ben?
Still hanging out. Look at all these stars. Have you seen this?
Yeah. Yeah, I have. Pretty great. Dance?
You can't handle it.
Now, I haven't done anything to the levels there. That's
no.
The music when Owen's character, Owen Wilson's character.
Well, he is dancing. We're on the radio here, but he is dancing. That's part of the reason why it gets big there.
But the song is coming from his car radio.
Yes.
And at the moment where the two characters are kind of looking at each other,
yeah.
Suddenly the music is a lot more present in the mix. And
absolutely.
You hear that line, you'll forget about me after I've been gone. So, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of intent in the way the music is used in that scene.
Well, yeah, and there's always intention. You always want to think about what the words that are playing, what the period you're using, what references that people have to it in other parts of their life, what references the characters have to it. And that song actually, Blake McCormick, who's one of the post-producer on the movie and works on Mad Men, he's a producer on Mad Men, he actually found that song. It was very, very hard to find the right song for Steve Dallas's radio in his convertible Chrysler. You know, it's a contemporary movie, but this guy is definitely rooted in a slightly different era. And when you hear that song, it's one of those songs that was so present in my adolescence. I don't even hear the words to it. It's just there. And it's one of these things, listening to it right now, where I'm just like, what a great song it is. There's a reason why it was such a huge hit. It's got a great rhythm. But we, partly the kitsch factor and partly the idea that song was sort of about, believe it or not, for there was an era where that song symbolized a kind of rebellion. A kind of like, you know, I don't give a damn sort of vibe. So part of it's kind of funny that's what he's listening to on the radio, because he's a very cool character. He's
right.
A very cool guy, and he's like, ladies like him, and he's got a great vibe to him. So there's something that's a little bit of a cheese factor. And then to me, the thing that really works about it is that the song, it's like when you imagine, you know, Journey or something, another band from this era. Journey's a little later, I guess. But when you imagine
80s,
someone sitting, these guys from Boston, I don't know what they look like. I know the album. It was everywhere. The song was everywhere. Just imagine someone sitting in a hotel room and writing that on a guitar. You can feel the feelings of the artist in some way. You know what? You have to take all the layers that come with the song. We used I've Got You, Babe on Mad Men at the end of the season. Well, I don't know if all that's true, 'cause you got me, baby, I got you. Hey, I got you, babe. Part of me was just saying, like, the song is 40 years old. No one knows that. No one knows this song came out in 1965. Nobody.
Yeah.
Let's put it there. It's like so forward-thinking in a way. It's definitely part of the folk movement, but it's got this pop vibe to it. We play it, and the first thing that comes to everyone's mind is Groundhog Day. And I totally, of course, I worship that movie, and I know, but I'm from an era where that song, that joke was for me. I knew that song already. I didn't hate it. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So you got to take into account all of the layers.
Did that surprise you when that happened? When people suddenly were going not back to the 60s, but to Bill Murray and that film?
I was a little bit surprised that was the reference, that was a bigger reference than the song by itself. Because also, you know, I know it will have the reference, but you kind of want them to take it in the purity of the moment. You know, you put the music to the picture and you have whatever magic that is. You know, the irony of probably the first thing that I ever saw that was like that was Dr. Strangelove at the end when they're
it's
playing.
It's a Wonderful World.
Yeah. No, they're playing We'll Meet Again.
We'll Meet Again.
Yeah. And while they're blowing the bombs off, you know, that kind of like instant irony. You just want to make sure that you always have a little bit of edge to it. We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know where.
We're speaking with Matthew Weiner, who's here to share a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck today. You'll know him as the creator of Mad Men, and his directorial debut is the film Are You Here?, which comes out August 22nd, Friday, in theaters and everywhere, video on demand. And Mad Men, the music kind of marks the passage of time. You know, it's
yes.
very closely tied to
yes.
the progression of...
I've had some songs, I mean, that are not from the period. But I try to, especially if it's source music, I mean, mm-hmm. I will never play anything that hasn't come out. But I was interested in the sort of the relationship of the, especially of the sort of white majority to the music. You know, the first season, there is no black music played until you hear The Twist, which is around episode 7. And I wanted it to have an effect in the life of the show, that you would see what that energy and what and the young people and dancing and sex all in that song. So
it was like an intrusion of an external reality into this kind of closeted world of
white privilege? No, it was an explosion of joy to accept others. You know, so much of the story of the show is about the subversive nature of American culture and the kind of infiltration of different kinds of people.
Yeah.
And whether Don Draper is trying to become the WASP that is in power, we see that he's faking it too. So that was what it was for me. And just to explain, you know, you get to last season on the show, we used My Way.
I've lived a life that's full. I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this, I did it my way.
I never knew I was going to get a chance to go that far into the 60s to even use it, but it was just an instant reality check for people's perception of the 60s to understand that that was a number one song in 1969, not just the Jefferson Airplane or whatever they think it is. That the culture is made. The Frank Sinatra had like 5 or 6 of his biggest hits from in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And it's not this bifurcation of the culture. And it's not like young people are like, ugh. I mean, lots of people don't like My Way because it's a little bit over the top. But Frank Sinatra has, you know, maybe by the time he records Being Green in the early 70s, the Muppets theme, he might sort of go off the rails with young people. But he cuts through, and the culture always has both of those things. And music, you know, when you hear Bob Dylan talking about listening to Ebb Tide,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I've used in the show a few times, a classic song like that is so musically complex, you try not to just like characterize it as like, oh, this is the business of music, old people like this, young people like that, et cetera.
Yeah, because as you say, it wasn't that clearly delineated.
It never is.
There were lots of young people who
it never is.
Heard My Way and thought, yeah, I get that.
Well, yeah. I mean, the story with Don and when we had the Beatles on the show, that story is basically derived. Someone told me that story, that the one thing they had in common with their father was listening to the Beatles. And then he listened to that song and he's like, this is not for me. Tomorrow Never Knows, which is an amazing song.
Yes. But there would have been a lot of moms and dads who were fine with the Beatles and wouldn't have been fine with that end of the Beatles.
How amazing is it that in the midst of their incredible commercial success, that is a lesson that keeps artists, to me, it keeps me going to like say like, to take a huge risk on a song like that. When people say do what you want to do or do what you feel like you want to do, and Tomorrow Never Knows is a perfect example on the same album as Eleanor Rigby.
Tomorrow Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles is a great song, but it's actually not part of the playlist.
Oh, sorry. Okay. No, it isn't. I just brought it up.
You know, we're spending a lot of time talking about music of the 60s and 60s and 70s. A lot of the music in the film Are You
yes.
Here is from the 70s.
Yes.
And your playlist is kind of 70s oriented. The Bee Gees, first of all, with How Deep Is Your Love?
Well, you know, let's be honest. I was asked for a song that I liked when I was, you know, when I was 14 or 15. So I turned 14 in, like, I think 1975. No, like 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the song. I love Saturday Night Fever. This was my favorite song of all those songs. I don't know why. It's got a great moment in the film, probably.
Mm.
You were already thinking
in terms of...
I guess certainly I would have never gone out and bought that album. I saw the movie with my grandmother, by the way, which is really embarrassing because it's really dirty.
And you were 14.
And I was 14. I was with my grandma took us to the movies. And she loved it. And she's from New York, and I guess she had that edge on her. But anyway, so there's a moment I remember pretty clearly. I think it's a morning song. It's like there's like a dissolve into a train ride, and it's in a montage. And I just love his voice, and... I still get a lot of feeling when I hear that song, and I know it's probably also got a big cheese factor. It's the Bee Gees. It was overplayed. It's overproduced, but it has a lot of feeling to it, and the words are kind of dumb, I guess, but everything about it, that some of the parts, it exceeds that.
Let's hear a little bit of the song, How Deep Is Your Love, from the Bee Gees.
Know your eyes in the morning sun. I feel you touch me in the pouring rain. And the moment that you wander far from me, I want to feel you in my arms again. And you come to me on a summer breeze. Keep me warm in your love. Then you softly leave. And it's me you need to share.
There's a melancholy to that, isn't there?
Kind of a morning after quality to it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an emotional song. It's weird to hear it out of context, but the movie my intention was to sort of make a 70s movie. I know it's contemporary, but that's part of why the music probably leans that way.
Okay, the movie Are You Here you're talking about.
Yes.
But that's, of course, from Saturday Night Fever.
Yes.
How Deep Is Your Love from the Bee Gees. My guest is Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men and the director of the forthcoming movie Are You Here, which is out in theaters and on video on demand on Friday the 22nd. He's here sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck today. Do you look for stories in songs?
Do I like music that has a story,
yeah,
or do I actually like get ideas for stories because of songs?
Well, you already said that you do get ideas
stories. Yeah, I do.
I'm thinking of, as we look through your playlist here, this David Bowie song, Soul Love. I mean, it's from the album Ziggy Stardust, which is a kind of an elliptical story that's being told.
I love it. I love it. I love any time anyone can tell a story. I like songs that create characters. Sometimes if the persona of the singer is strong enough, you think it's happening to them. And sometimes they play different characters and they disappear into it. So any kind of communication that's emotional, I'm susceptible to.
And her eyes, for they penetrate her grieving. Talking new words that only they can share in new words. A love so strong it tears their hearts to see through the bleeding hours of morning. Love is careless in its choosing, screaming over. Race.
Soul Love from David Bowie's record The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Picked for us by Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men and the director of the forthcoming movie Are You Here? Out on August 22nd. Well, you picked Amy Mann.
Yeah, I picked Amy Mann because I love Amy Mann. I live with Amy Mann's music all the time.
Oh, Susan, you were clued in. You knew just how this thing would go.
Let's talk about Amy.
Well, you know, she was like one of the first indie rockers, you know, part of the machine with the commercial success of her band Till Tuesday, and then decided to go her own way.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, as an artist, she's made decisions that have a lot of resonance with other art forms around
absolutely
the world.
And her music has been used in movies a lot, and I think it's got a great cinematic quality to it. And I think that she's a storyteller. Her songs tell stories, and she has a character that she puts on for each song, different voices. I've gotten to the point in my life after listening to so much music and being the age that I am where I actually think there's a biological resonance of the sound of certain people's voices. And for me, her voice goes right. It's got a lot of feeling in it.
Well, and she adopts one of those characters in this song called Susan, which we'll use to wrap up Matthew Weiner's Pick 3 playlist here on Soundcheck today. Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, now has his directorial debut coming out on Friday the 22nd. It's the film called Are You Here? Starring Owen Wilson and Zach Galifianakis and Amy Poehler and Laura Ramsey. It'll be available on video on demand and in theaters in select cities around the country. Matthew, it's been a lot of fun talking music with you today.
Me too, John. It's a pleasure.
Now I'm in that place again, and I know he can't come in to get me, and someday he will live to regret me. Susan, I can't see it now.
Up next, it's been 10 years since Zach Braff's film Garden State and its landmark soundtrack, and we will look back at that soundtrack in just a moment. And then later, the band Gem Club plays some of their haunting chamber pop live in our studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 10 years ago, the actor, Zach Braff, released his directorial debut, the film Garden State.
There's a handful of normal kid things I kind of missed.
There's a handful of normal kid things I kind of wish I'd missed.
You know that point in your life when you realize the house you grew up in isn't really your home anymore? And all of a sudden, even though you have some place where you put your shit, that idea of home is gone.
Feel at home in my house.
The movie itself was pretty successful, receiving a nomination for a grand jury prize at the Sundance Film Festival, among other accolades. But it was the movie's soundtrack, a mixtape of sincere indie pop songs like this one, Frou Frou's Let Go, that really captured the hearts of many.
Drink a baby down.
One such fan was, and is, Reggie Ugwu, who is now the deputy music editor at BuzzFeed. And he recently wrote an essay for that website called Listening in the Abyss, The Lasting Legacy of the Garden State Soundtrack. You can find it at soundcheck.org, and you can find Reggie right here in the Soundcheck studio. Hi, Reggie.
Hey, John, how's it going?
Good. So it's 10 years since this album was released.
10 years, hard to believe.
Where were you? What were you doing 10 years ago?
10 years ago, I was a college freshman, kind of the mopey, sensitive kid that this movie really appealed to. And the soundtrack was kind of hit me in a transitional phase in my life, and I think for a lot of other people.
So was it an immediate connection for you, or is it something that had to develop over 10 years?
It was an immediate connection. Already at that time, I was kind of exploring and testing the boundaries of my music taste and discovering all these indie bands that I had never listened to prior to college. And the soundtrack came right just the right time, so I was kind of already on that trajectory.
Had you seen the film?
I had. I think the film came first. The film was kind of one of those things like, you know, like Donnie Darko or one of these movies that was, or Eternal Sunshine that was on the shelves of every college kid at the time, it seemed. And after seeing the film is when I got into the soundtrack.
All right. Now, I got to level with you, Reggie. I have not seen Garden State.
Oh,
everything
no.
I know about
John.
This movie, I know only because of the soundtrack.
Well, so, that's good. That's my case.
So talk me through give me a thumbnail of the film.
The film is kind of a classic You Can't Go Home Again or Coming Home Again story. It's a little bit like a millennial version of The Graduate, where this guy goes home to New Jersey after his mother's death and reconnects with all these kids from high school and is kind of aimlessly wandering around. He's like a failed actor coming home from L.A.
Huh. So you mentioned The Graduate. I know that there's an old Simon and Garfunkel song on the soundtrack to Garden State.
It's true, and some people have kind of pointed that as kind of an overt reference to, you know, that Mike Nichols film, yeah.
Yeah. But most of the soundtrack are these then-current indie bands, and it really kind of marks a moment in time.
Definitely.
So tell us about the moment when we hear this song by 07 called In the Waiting Line.
The moment in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's right when he has just come home and he's kind of sitting in the basement of one of his friends who's got rich off this kind of cockamamie invention, and they're taking drugs and partying and kind of letting loose, and he's going to take his mind off of the weight of his mother passing, and someone passes him a pill of ecstasy with a smiley face on it.
Should we play a game? Let's play Spin the Bottle.
I'm not playing Spin the Bottle. How old are we? Or more importantly, how old are they?
Oh, they're all legal, I think.
Well, we just ate all this X, so what the hell else are we supposed to do?
Girl has a point.
Right.
Waiting Line from the band 07 off of the Garden State soundtrack. The film was released on July 28, 2004. The soundtrack released August 10, 2004. And Reggie Ugwu, the deputy music editor for BuzzFeed, has written about the 10th anniversary of the release of the soundtrack in an essay that you can find at soundcheck.org. He's here with me in the Soundcheck studio. And you say in the essay, Reggie, that Zach Braff's genius here is in the way that he was able to curate. This is 2004. The way he curates our experience as listeners without the benefits of Spotify or Pandora or Tumblr. So he couldn't do this today? It would be a different thing somehow?
I think he could do it today. The problem is there are so many other people who are doing this now. We're kind of in a curatorial age now where you have your Pandoras, you have your Spotify playlists, you have your Last.fms, you have your Beats Musics, you know, being valued at $3 billion, you know. And everyone is kind of in this game. But at the time, it was different. It wasn't so prevalent, the idea that, you would be able to share something like this with all these different artists who most people hadn't heard of, mm-hmm. and present it in a very coherent way, and then have it catch on in just the right way.
Do you get the impression that Zach Braff came up with the soundtrack first and then kind of like wrote around it, or did he just like find the perfect songs for different scenes?
I think it was very much simultaneously. You know, they say that he used to send out copies of the soundtrack with the script when the movie was just being developed. One thing that I found out in researching the essay and talking with some of the people who worked on the soundtrack is that it came from his friends at the time. Like, it was people who he was around in L.A. That literally are on the soundtrack and that introduced him to other songs that were then made the soundtrack. So
Cary Brothers, for example.
Cary Brothers, who sings the song Blue Eyes on the soundtrack, was actually a college friend of Zach Braff's. And he, you know, no one knew who Cary Brothers was, but he had this song, Blue Eyes, this kind of acoustic, sad, plaintive song, and Zach loved it, and he was a friend of Carrie's, and he put it on the soundtrack. And now Cary today still has a career in doing other soundtracks and touring and all of that.
So did Zach Braff then kind of write a scene around his friend's song?
I don't think it was that explicit or that interlinked, but it was more, it was in his, it was kind of in his orbit at the time, and he said, oh, you know, that song would be perfect for this scene.
And what is the scene?
The scene is a scene where Natalie Portman's character is talking to Zach Braff's character in a bar, and she's revealing the fact that she has epilepsy, but she's laughing about it. And you know, in comparison to the problems that Zach Braff is having at the time, you know, it's a pretty serious condition, but she's able to laugh about it, and it just talks about the importance of being able to find humor in life.
All right, let's hear the song by Cary Brothers called Blue Eyes.
Wise man will tell you a lie. When the broke tongue screams, who thought you'd dream of a single tragic scene? I just want to sing a song with you. I just wanna take it off of you.
Cary Brothers, previously unknown before this song Blue Eyes appeared on the soundtrack to Zach Braff's movie Garden State. The soundtrack went platinum. It received a 2005 Grammy for Best Compilation Soundtrack Album. It is now 10 years old, and we're talking about it with Reggie Ugwu, deputy music editor for BuzzFeed. And Reggie, you know, there is one moment, as I said, I haven't seen the film, but even I know about this moment, where the shins are invoked on screen. And it seems like there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who heard the Garden State soundtrack and like got immediately into all these artists. And then there are the people who were into some of these artists and then heard the soundtrack and were like, oh my God, what's happened?
Right, exactly.
Was this one of those moments for the Shins?
Well, it was very much so. But at the same time, you know, I think if you talk to the Shins now, they would tell you that, you know, half of their audience, well, more than half of their audience that they have today, they wouldn't have that same audience if it wasn't for the soundtrack. So, you know, even though some of the fans may have not have been so happy to have their precious secret exposed to the world, so many more fans discover them because of it.
And it's because of this moment where Zach Braff's character, Andrew, is talking to Natalie Portman's character, Sam, in a waiting room at the doctor's office.
What are you listening to?
The Shins. You know them?
No.
You gotta hear this one song. It'll change your life, I swear. Oh, I'm sorry. You have to, you gotta fill out your forms. Conundrum. Think you could, maybe listen while you could?
I think I can handle it.
Yeah? Okay.
Curse for this town, rolling my mouth.
It's good. I like it.
It's almost like product placement, isn't it?
Product placement for indie bands.
For indie bands.
Yeah, and since then, indie bands are soundtracking a lot of advertisements. So,
right, right.
Literally product placement.
But this is 10 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, for people who were Shins fans, it was like, oh, my God, he's ruined everything. But that, you know, that's always been, I guess, you know.
Yeah, you know, that idea of kind of going mainstream or crossing over is pretty old at this point.
Now, Zach Braff seems to have recognized that people had, you know, kind of mixed feelings about what he was doing, because on Saturday Night Live in 2007, he did this funny thing where there's this high school class, you know, the skit, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. So
this high school class is trying to select a prom theme, and Zach Braff is one of the students with a suggestion.
Next up is Brian Bergstein.
Looking out at all of you, I think, wow, what a generation we are. And then I think, you know, I love James Bond, but what is the movie of our generation? What is the film that most spoke to our alienation in the infinite abyss that is our young lives?
Are you going to talk about Garden State again?
Why shouldn't we talk about Garden State? Garden State talked about us, right? Think about it. We could play the entire Grammy-winning soundtrack.
That won a Grammy? It was like a Pitchfork mix CD.
I happen to know those songs were very carefully chosen.
Okay, fine. We're moving on.
Well, I don't care what you guys say. That soundtrack changed my life.
Well, now, the punchline there, you can't hear it very well, but at the end of the skit, Zach Braff's character puts on his headphones and you hear a few seconds of that Shins.
Of new slang, yeah.
New slang by the Shins. So, 10 years on, how does the soundtrack hold up? Let me ask you, and let me also ask our listeners, because, folks, if you listen to the Garden State soundtrack, you know, if you listen to it now, does it stir up 10-year-old memories? Tell us how you feel now or how you felt then by leaving a comment on our website at soundcheck.org. Reggie, what about you?
You know, I think it still has that effect when you hear it. It kind of grabs you and transports you back to that time. And the songs hold pretty well together, even though there are some slight differences in genre. I don't think there's any dramatic shifts, but... it still has that sort of emotional grasp, I think. But it's funny to listen to it now because it really does sound like 2004. I think if we were to make an indie mix today, it would be a lot more electronic, a lot more experimental, and less sort of the singer-songwriter kind of guitar-y acoustic vibe.
Yeah. As we mentioned earlier, there are two older songs. We mentioned the Simon and Garfunkel song, Only Living Boy in New York. And then there's also Nick Drake, One of These Things First. Now that sort of fits in with the whole acoustic, strummy singer-songwriter vibe.
Exactly, yeah.
But Nick Drake was also kind of having a cultural moment back then.
It's kind of... That thing of these artists finding a new audience in these kind of curatorial vehicles.
Well, we'll hear a little bit of the Nick Drake song from the Garden State soundtrack, and Reggie Ugwu's recent essay on the 10th anniversary of the soundtrack is called Listening in the Abyss, the Lasting Legacy of the Garden State Soundtrack. Reggie, so nice of you to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I could have been a sailor, could have been a cook. A real life lover, could have been a book. I could have been a signpost, could have been a clock. As simple as a kettle, steady as a rock.
Up next, the trio known as Gem Club performs live in the studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Listening to the music of the Massachusetts-based group called Gem Club is a bit like looking at a cut gem. It has a unique internal order, and it can be very glittery. Gem Club's newest record is called In Roses, and the band is here in the studio to play a few songs from it for us, but they're actually going to start us off with a song from their previous album, 2011's Breakers. Here is Gem Club with a song called Twins, live on Soundcheck.
Before I can learn whose twin I was.
That is the band Gem Club, live here in our Soundcheck studio with a song called Twins, which you'll find on their 2011 album Breakers. The band's most recent album is called In Roses, And let me introduce you to the members of Gem Club, the singer and songwriter Christopher Barnes at our piano. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, how are you?
With Kristen Drymala playing the cello and Yeva Berberian playing keyboards. There's no percussionist there, and yet both you and Kristen found ways to make percussive sounds during that piece.
Yeah.
Kristen rapping on the body of the cello at one point, yeah. And you almost using the foot pedals as a kind of percussive sound.
I have a heavy foot on the damper, and I think that we use a lot of synths on stage to replicate the piano, but one of the things that I love about being able to play a real piano is that you can get sort of that canon type boom with a foot pedal. At school, I got criticized for that a lot.
Yeah, that's not the technique they teach at conservatory, is it?
No. People are not a fan of that.
So that piece, Twins, has been choreographed a couple of times. You posted a couple of... Were you surprised?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's beautiful to see people sort of take the work and use it in their own medium. I mean, it's totally touching. And they sort of popped up on YouTube. And I think one person actually posted it to the Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. So... And at least one of the two videos, which you've now posted on your website, is kind of a very slow, stylized form of hip-hop choreography, which, you know, might not be the first place you go when listening to Gem Club.
I know nothing really about dance, I think. I mean, that's probably something I should look into just out of, you know, sheer curiosity. But, I mean, I was pretty, I think it was two very... different universes coming together in a really interesting way.
Absolutely. Now, a lot of your music, even on the new record, that song being from the previous one, mm-hmm. you know, it does inhabit a kind of stately and very, at times, very somber. People say it's very sad or melancholy, and that certainly is the case with some of the pieces. Do you ever feel the need to have a little Richard moment? You know, get your foot up on the keyboard and that kind of stuff?
My dad was always like, can you play? When I was a kid, he would say, you know, he'd show me Jerry Lee Lewis. He's like, can you do that? No, Dad, I can't do that. I think I've always felt extremely uncomfortable playing like that.
Hmm. Well, now, the other thing about this new record is it is, for the most part, a collection of songs, mm-hmm. but not exclusively. There are several instrumental tracks. Mm-hmm. And even within the songs, there are a couple that have long instrumental passages. Mm-hmm. It's known that our brain responds differently to music when there's a voice or when there isn't.
Sure.
Do you write differently?
Do I write differently?
If you know the piece is going to be instrumental or vocal.
No. I think that the instrumental pieces came... I think sometimes I know when a piece needs to be wordless and when a piece, you know, when the words fit. I think songs tell you a lot. In what they want. I think that that's something they do very well. The instrumental pieces, we use them to sort of flank the sides of the record. So from the first side, we sequenced it so that From Nowhere to QY2 was sort of our quote-unquote lighter material. And then from QY2 to Poly was the heavier material. And it also forces people, we knew we were going to press it on vinyl. At the time, we didn't know that it was actually going to be two records. But in theory, I liked the idea of having one side and so that you'd have to physically get up and turn the thing over. So you'd start with an instrumental, and then the record would finish, and you'd get up and you'd turn it over, and then you'd have another instrumental, and it would finish that way. That was
the conception was that this was going to be an LP.
It never starts out that way. It ends up like that. I think that in the writing process, you know, the last thing I want to think about is sequencing a number of songs because it makes me panic stricken. So I think that you set out to do, you know, you just set out to create as much as possible. And then through that, you start editing and you start arranging. And I feel like themes come in. But those first two songs, you never know.
Well, you know, it's almost... or at least for a while was threatening to be a lost art, the art of sequencing an album, because back in the day of the LP, you know, you had to think really long and hard about what your first track was going to be, your third track on side one, what was going to lead, what was going to be your finale.
Yeah.
And this album, I mean, I wasn't aware that you had structured the, you know, because I listened to
sure.
a series of 12 digital files.
Right.
And yet there was definitely a sequence, a very strong sense of sequence. By the end of the album, you're just like, oh, my God.
Good.
You know,
good.
It's like being punched in the gut, but softly.
Softly, gently. A gentle disturbance.
A gentle disturbance in the force.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, those are some of my favorite records, you know, growing up. I think song order is extremely important, and I think that with digital, I don't know. And it's also like the shortening of attention spans, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's being thought of as much.
What were some of your, I mean, those go-to records for you? What
for
were
me,
they?
Well, I grew up in the 90s, so a lot of that music was intensely emotionally driven music. My favorite were PJ Harvey, Tori Amos, Bjork, like intensely emotional, personal driven, mm-hmm. you know, songwriters.
Often scary in the case of PJ Harvey.
I think brave, you know, I think very brave.
All right. Well, the latest album by Gem Club is called In Roses. It is out now, and it's about time we heard something from it. You want to do Hypericum for us? What is Hypericum?
It's a little yellow flower. It's also known as St. John's wort.
St. John's wort, which people take for memory or depression or stuff like that.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's send you back to the Steinway there.
Yes.
Christopher Barnes making his way back to the piano with, once again, Kristen Drymala on cello and Yeva Berberian playing the electric keyboard. Here in the Soundcheck studio, the band is Gem Club. The song is called Hypericum.
Thank you.
Once again, the band is Gem Club from Somerville, Massachusetts, but playing live here in our New York studio on Soundcheck, and a song called Hypericum, which you will find on the most recent Gem Club release called In Roses. And Christopher Barnes, once again, at our piano. Yeva Berberian adding some backing vocals there, and Kristen Dreimala playing the cello, of course. Christopher, this has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, I've had a blast.
Of your spiraling and your salted gears, and I'm chained to the strength of your way.
Tomorrow on the show, Josephine Baker became famous, or infamous, as a singer and actress, and then later a civil rights activist. But a new book details a less-known facet of her life, her quest to construct what she referred to as a rainbow tribe of 12 adopted children. We'll talk to the book's author. Plus, I'll go head-to-head with one unlucky Soundcheck listener in a quiz about some of the older folks who've been making pop chart history in recent weeks. That's going to do it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.